Drive.
Thank you, be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Prudential Insurance Company of America versus Jefferson Associates Limited and F.B. Goldman. Justice Enoch has recused in this case.
May it please the court, Mr. Don L. Hill, Jr. will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Get more of me than you want, I'm sure, but we did handle both of these cases from the beginning. Just a word of background here, if I might, about the plaintiffs. To start with, Mr. Goldman, he's well-known, and this is important, I think, to looking at this case in the real world. He's a well-known Dallas-based professional real estate investor. His forte is to buy and sell real estate properties, hopefully at a profit. And one of the properties that he coveted for his substantial investment portfolio was the Jefferson Building, key and center of this case, owned by Prudential, located in Austin. The building was a little over 10 years old when he bought it from Prudential in May 1984. It's been well built by Richard Harden and Company, was well located in the Seton Hospital medical area, was fully leased, and was being operated and managed profitably for Prudential by the John Brazil Building Management Company, whose on-site office manager was Mrs. Donna Buchanan, who was not incidentally an engineer or architect and had no construction or technical background. So Mr. Goldman had tried to buy this building on two previous occasions, but Prudential was not yet ready to sell. Finally, in early 1984, Prudential put up several buildings for closed bid sales to raise needed cash due to heavy borrowings against its life insurance values by its policyholders, and we'll all remember those occasions.
Counsel, so is it your position here that the rule of law that we write, given the special status of the plaintiff in this case, need not apply to some doctor who had gone out there and this is the first building that the person had ever purchased?
That's correct. And one of the buildings that was put into this sales program was the Jefferson Building. And Mr. Goldman, through a broker, John Ehrlich here, heard of this and immediately contacted Prudential to see about being a bidder. Prudential people in charge of the sale were Mr. Miller and Mr. Ethics of Dallas, and they told Mr. Goldman he's welcome to bid in the Jefferson Building and was free to conduct any inspection of the building that he desired prior to bidding. And Miller and Ethics made no representations or statements about the condition of the building, and Mr. Hearn conceded an argument that neither of them had any knowledge that the building contained any building materials that had any asbestos in them. The Miller and Ethics worked in separate divisions, approved known as the Real Estate Investment Division. Mr. Goldman proceeded with his due diligence, as any experienced realtor would. He personally inspected the building on one and maybe two occasions, he wasn't sure which. He sent his VP of Maintenance and Construction to Austin to spend a full day going over the building with a fine-tooth comb and rendering him a full written report. And then finally, he hired the well-known, highly respected architect and engineering firm, Houston Espy and Company, to meticulously go over the building and render him a detailed written report, which even incidentally reported to Mr. Goldman on the fact that the building did contain fireproofing material, although they didn't take a sample of the material, which would have revealed the presence of some asbestos materials in the fireproofing. When the fireproofing, with all of this information then that he had before it, Mr. Goldman bid in the building for $7,150,000 and was a successful bidder and purchaser in what is known in the real estate trade as an as-is contract, point of error number one. It contained the usual and customary as-is language, which I would like to refer to briefly. Seller and purchaser agree that purchaser is taking the property as is, with any and all patent and latent defects, and that there is no warranty by seller that the property is fit for a particular purpose. Purchaser acknowledges that it is not relying upon any representation, statement, or other assertion with respect to the property condition, but is relying upon its examination of the property. The sale was concluded May 1984. Prudential offered to finance over $5 million of the purchase price, but at an interest rate that Mr. Goldman could beat, he finally ended up with another lender for $6 million, and to his good credit, and even better for him, was non-recourse financing. Everything went along normal until 1987, when Mr. Goldman decided to refinance the building. Asbestos in buildings was getting to be a hotter and hotter topic, and in real estate circles. So this new lender-to-be wanted a more detailed laboratory-type inspection to nail down whether in any of the materials in the building there was any substantial asbestos. And at that time, it was discovered through that laboratory analysis that the monocoat fireproofing material made and distributed by W.R. Grace, sprayed on the steel girders by the hardened construction people at the time of construction back in 71, did contain some asbestos. And the asbestos was not displaced, was not airborne, it was causing no harm. The investigators recommended it not be removed or disturbed, and at question, just put in a maintenance and operation air sampling program was their recommendation. It cost you $61,000, and it was installed, and it has worked very well.
Mr. Hill, may I stop you right there ask you, to what extent does an as-is clause in a sales contract render an otherwise actionable misrepresentation by the seller not subject to any suit for damages?
If there's no false misrepresentation, if there's no fraudulent misrepresentation, as is the effect of an as-is contract, where there's inspection like this, where you have not interfered with that inspection, allocates the risk of any deficiency in the economic value of the property to the purchaser.
In the absence of fraud,
in absence
then,
of fraud.
How about under Singleton versus Pennington, the type of representations that might be made as to, one of the finest little properties in Austin that might otherwise be actionable under the DTPA, to what extent do you contend that an as-is clause bars that lawsuit?
My answer to that is that the statements that you're talking about, comparing them to Pennington, where they said in Pennington that the motor was good, tip-top shape, would work well, and it's been worked on, and virtually new, was just a lie.
Here they say no defects except for one crack in the basement.
Beg your pardon? All she was asked was, I'm getting a little ahead, but that's all right. All that Donna Buchanan was asked by Mr. Kirk, Mr. Goldman's man, who came down here, he's vice president of maintenance and construction. She was the office manager. He asked her, do you know of any defects or problems in the building? A very routine, obvious question. I'm sure he had no concept or idea that Ms. Buchanan would know anything about the subject that we're talking about here, about asbestos and monocoat fireproofing. She said, I don't know of any defect. The only problem I know about is there's a sliding foundation problem in the basement, which has been worked on and is going to be corrected, and it was. Now, that is not a material misrepresentation. It would be ludicrous, Your Honors, to think for a moment that someone like Mr. Goldman, a sophisticated real estate man, was relying on that in making his decision. If that were the case, under as is, all I'd have to do, I'd say, yeah, I'll buy it as is, and I'll get the benefit of the contract, which is what you do when you buy as is. It's negotiated, and you get a lower price. But I'm going to sit down there and ask somebody that's not too much in the loop if they know of any defects, and if they say no, I got you. and get out from under the as-is contract on the basis of some false misrepresentation. There is no false misrepresentation in this case.
So does
it vitiate as-is?
Does it take an affirmative misrepresentation?
It's an affirmative misrepresentation, yes, sir. The when the real estate market slumped here, Mr. Goldman elected to sue us because of the presence of this asbestos, and he was enormously successful, not only in keeping the building with his nice non-recourse note, but to also recover a jury verdict for almost $25 million, including a $14 million legal windfall punitive damage award. He truly won the lottery. And we say, Your Honor, this is a miscarriage of justice under the facts of this case. There's simply no legal basis here for a cause of action against Prudential. If this verdict is allowed to stand, not only will a seller who has violated no laws, who has not affirmatively misrepresented, as I said, anything, and who was an as-is seller, to a sophisticated buyer, as Justice Doggett pointed out, that's a very big distinction, have lost the benefit of its bargain and have been tagged in the interim with a damage award that's an absolute perversion of justice in our view. This has all been done on the strength of some evidence about Prudential's problems with asbestos in other buildings, a lot of which evidence occurred after the sale, most of which was public knowledge, plus the proof of the fact that Prudential had itself sued the manufacturers of Monaco Asbestos in 1987 for damages which swirled around in the courtroom quite extensively, and I think very confusing as to the time things happened. But be that as it may, none of those facts, highly inflammatory as they were before the jury, were basically irrelevant, because under an as-is contract, there was no legal duty on the part of an as-is seller to disclose that kind of information. We don't have to stand here, and I know we probably will, and battle around about what the record shows and what the crew really know, and when did they know it, and did they actually have a policy later on where they were not going to get into any more buildings that had asbestos, and what was their market strategy. None of that is relevant to this case, because an as-is seller does not have to disclose any of that information to an as-is buyer. We've set out before you the La Placenta case and the 3250 Wilshire Boulevard case, both cases involving asbestos in buildings, both cases strikingly similar to this case, in which the courts, one applying Arizona law and one California law, no difference in our basic disclosure laws, have said that is not a duty that we are going to extend a disclosure law to. That's too broad, that's too way out, that would mean that people would have to disclose all kinds of things, have to go interrogate, I guess, thousands of people in the organization. What do you know? What did you learn yesterday? That is the purpose of an as-is contract, to allocate risk of that type. As-is is an honored vehicle in this state. Ever since Mid-Continent case, saying it's a well-respected and well-needed doctrine. Now, I want to say more about it. I see my time is going to get me here. I want to say more about it. Let there be no doubt that as-is is a very, very necessary part of the real estate community operation in this state. It is not used to cloak fraud. No one here seeks to use it to cloak fraud or to cloak fraudulent misrepresentation. That's not in the case. We're seeking not to have it destroyed by evidence of this type, which does not, it's the type of evidence that should not be allowed to overcome a time-honored transactional method that's used day after day after day. No wonder we've drawn so many amici in this case from the real estate industry and others, if they know the devastating effect that this case would have if you would fail not to enforce the as-is contract as it's written in this case.
Can the sellers stand behind an as-is clause and still impede the purchaser's ability to identify upon inspection defects in the property?
No, sir.
And how would you distinguish what happened in this case from
Grant Street? Well, if there ever was a classic case of freedom to inspect, he inspected it maybe twice.
They say Prudential had the plans and specifications.
Had plans and specifications. That's not the biggest afterthought, a red herring. Donna Buchanan, obviously the office manager, doesn't keep plans and specifications. She told them that if they wanted them, the architects were in that building. They were clients and tenants in that building. They didn't go and get them. Nobody kept them from any kind of an inquiry they wanted. They could make it any kind of a test that they wanted to. And Mr. Goldman himself, and this is outcome determinative testimony, he said, I would like to have had them, but it really didn't make any difference to me. I would have closed anyway. So there was no reliance on the fact that he didn't have plans and specifications. He knew that he was looking and his people were looking at what we call what the tenants used to build. If they wanted to go and get that asbestos material, fireproof material that they knew was there and do some more investigating on it, they could have done it. They didn't do it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please support Mr. Robert Heron will present argument for respondents.
May I please support Mr. Hill has presented Prudential's view of the facts. The jury disagreed with that. This court doesn't sit to render a verdict on the facts. The issue here is whether there is evidence to support what the jury found. I prepared some exhibits, charts, some of which may not get to, but I hope all of you have them by tab number. And with the court's permission, I think it's essential to familiarize the court with what really happened in this case and what is in the record, which apparently Mr. Hill doesn't want us to examine. In the first place, it is undisputed that the petitioners here suffered $6 million in actual damages in buying for $7 million a building that was worth at most one. That is undisputed. There was no contrary testimony presented. Secondly, this case is strongly impacted by an agreed-upon general charge submitting all of the issues of liability. You have the full charge under tab 1 in your book, but look at this question 1. Prudential agreed that the jury would simply be asked, do you find, from a preponderance, that the plaintiff should be entitled to recover damages as a result of any wrongful conduct? That's the broad issue, the liability issue, on which this case was tried. Obviously, a conscious decision by Prudential, if they got a favorable verdict with that issue, there's no way it could be touched on appeal. We think the contra applies just as well. Look at the pleadings in this case. Tab 3. Those allegations allege fraud in every guise. Statutory fraud in the sale of real estate, affirmative misrepresentations, constructive fraud. You can read the list as well as I. DTPA violations, affirmative misrepresentations, unconscionability, taking advantage of Mr. Goldman, who did not have the sophisticated knowledge of asbestos that Prudential did. Gross disparity in value, selling a building for $7 million when it was worth $6 million. All of those issues were then submitted by agreement under this one jury question, which the jury answered in favor of respondents here.
Mr. Heron, what benefit is it to a seller to sell a building as is?
I'll get to that a little later, but let me tell you now. I don't want to, I think, number one, it means that there aren't going to be any renovations in the building. It's sold like it is. The price should take into account that the carpet is not going to be replaced. It imposes the risk of loss, casualty loss, on the seller, pending in the interval between signing the contract and the closing. And, of course, under Mid-Continent case, it negates any implied contractual warranty.
That's all?
That's
just
all.
Implied contractual warranty?
That's all.
So the only deference a court ought to give an as-is risk allocation clause in a contract would be in a case asserting implied warranties.
I think a jury can give it some consideration. In deciding all these jury issues that Mr. Hill was arguing, the jury in this case took into account the fact that there was an as-is clause, decided whether or not Mr. Goldman was as sophisticated an investor as Prudential. And as the restatement points out, it can boil down to a fact issue. But if Ms. Wallace can stand it, let me turn to the tail end of the argument, what I intended to do at the end, and show you what Mr. Biggio, Prudential's in-house lawyer, who testified in this case, what he said as is meant in this case. He was asked, does it have the general effect of relieving the seller of disclosing defects? I would say no.
Well, in that regard, what does it mean to take the property with any and all latent and patent defects? What does that mean if it doesn't mean?
I think it means that that's what happens, unless that contract was induced by fraud.
Well, what does it mean when it says purchaser acknowledges that it is not relying upon any representation, statement, or other assertion with respect to the property condition?
I think it means just that, and that's enforced unless that was induced by fraud. Let me turn in this area of my argument.
Well, how could you be relying on it in some circumstances and not relying on it when the contract says you're not relying upon it? You're not relying upon any representation, statement, or other assertion.
Tab 11. This court in 1957, a unanimous opinion, Justice Calvert reviewed all of the authorities, including authorities cited by Prudential in this case, and said, Justice Heck, you're right. It would be good if the law was certain and all of those things could be enforced, but if that contract, no matter what it says, that there's a merger clause, there's an inspection clause, there's an as-is clause, if that was preceded by misrepresentations, wrongful conduct, those clauses do not prevent proof of that, nor do they prevent either rescission of the contract or recovery of damage.
Well, let me see how far that goes. If the building manager had said the carpet was 3 years old and in fact it was eight, would that be something that you could sue for and despite the as-is clause?
Well, at some point a jury comes into here. I think that's not this case.
But the answer is yes. If you're going to a jury, the answer is yes.
If that raises a fact issue based on the circumstances of that case, it's going to go to a jury as to whether that was a sufficient affirmative misrepresentation to overcome the as-is clause.
Well, then the clause doesn't have any meaning at all.
Of course it does, Your Honor.
You knew that it was 8 years old carpet, and the buyer thought it was 3 years old and said, thank God this building only has three-year-old carpet because I wouldn't buy it otherwise. And you're sitting there knowing that it has eight-year-old carpet. If you don't speak up, you're innocent.
But, Your Honor, with all respect, this is not an eight-year-old carpet case. This is an asbestos case, and I appreciate the concerns that you have about the carpet case. But let me suggest that the carpet case is not before the court. And I'm anxious to be sure that the court here understands what did happen.
As you well know from the amici briefs that have been filed, what is before the court is the scope of the ruling in this case as it pertains to as-is clauses. And what I'm trying to get at is how far does it go? And I take it your answer is it could cover something as relatively insignificant as the age of the carpet.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think that's what Justice Calvert and the court said in 57. What we're dealing with here in Dallas Farm Machinery against Reeves is whether there has been some pre-contract misrepresentation sufficient under the circumstances to justify setting this contract aside.
If so, then
you never get the contract. Excuse
the only
me.
Oral misrepresentation that you complain of, that of Ms. Buchanan?
Well, let me get back to what's the affirmative misrepresentations were made by Ms. Buchanan. They are that there are no defects in the building and that Prudential did not have the plans and specifications, both of which were false.
She was an office manager.
Let me get into that. Prudential said, Mr. Goldman, if you have any questions about this building, go ask the people who were in charge of the building management of the building, Ms. Buchanan and Ms. Brazil. Authority. She was told that Prudential is directing these purchasers to you. She wasn't just some office person. And she said she was told, if I don't have it, not to withhold anything, and if I don't have the information, I'll get it for you. She was the focus. Now, what's the problem with that? Restatement 256 says it's an artifice, it's a device. If somebody attempts to avoid liability for failing to disclose by using an innocent agent for that purpose. There's the car dealer case cited in our brief.
Well, the representations that she is alleged to have made, there's evidence that she made, don't strike me as being in response to a very vigorous inquiry as to the condition of the building.
Your Honor, as a juror, perhaps you would have decided this case differently. But the only question is whether there is any evidence to support a jury finding under this wrongful conduct issue. And affirmative misrepresentation is simply one. A policy of active concealment by Prudential of the existence of asbestos in its buildings nationwide, coupled with a decision to stonewall, sell as many of these buildings as you can to unwitting buyers until such time as everybody then knows about asbestos, at which time we will have to engage in asbestos abatement. But in the meantime, let's get rid of as many as we can.
There is evidence.
Yes.
All that.
Yes.
The record.
There certainly is, Your Honor, and the jury could have found it.
And as far as the concern that a number of these amicus briefs have raised about as-is clauses, you're not asking this court to write the law a word broader than we did in 1957.
Not at all. There's no reason to rewrite the 57.
That's not an as-is case, is it?
Yes.
It's a merger.
No, Judge Calvert reviewed all of the cases.
What's a merger clause?
Yes, but he reviewed as-is cases, and he wrote that as a matter of policy, this court, quoting from the Massachusetts court, should adopt this rule.
The plans and specifications which Prudential had, at least available to them, would have revealed the presence of monocoat.
Exactly. Let's
monocoat. Monocoat sometimes contains asbestos and sometimes does not. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Was there any additional proof that the type of monocoat that would have been revealed in these buildings was the kind of monocoat that had asbestos in it, or merely that monocoat was used?
Tab 5, Your Honor.
Okay.
Testimony of Mr. Zielinski, Prudential's Director of Architecture. The specs are at the top. Cementitious setting type monocoat is manufactured by Grace. And I won't read all that to you, but the substance of it is that Zielinski knew that as this asbestos product evolved, it contained asbestos at the time this building was built.
So Mr. Zielinski, however you pronounce his name, acknowledged that it was possible that the type of monocoat present in this building was an asbestos, contained asbestos.
No, I don't think it's not just a mere possibility. Here, I think, again, we're talking about what the jury found.
Well, are you relying on more than the display testimony here?
Oh, yes.
What other testimony can you point us to, please, in the statement of facts, which identifies Prudential's knowledge that their type of monocoat that was present in this building was the type that actually did contain asbestos?
I'll give you a list, Your Honor, if I may, by post-submission memorandum. I can't do it here. Okay. Let me turn to tab 10 and what has really happened in this case, and that is how Prudential dealt with discovery in this case. Prudential had sued W.R. Grayson Company in 1987, seeking the same kind of damages that the plaintiffs are here. 1987, bear that in mind. 1988, a DTPA letter was written in this case, and here is the response. We may have known about asbestos, but we didn't know in May of 84 that asbestos could result in a substantial diminution. Look at the other discovery responses. Here in 88, they told us and the court they didn't know whether monocoat was used, whether W.R. Grayson Company manufactured monocoat, or whether monocoat contained asbestos, even though the year before they had sued Grayson, making all of those allegations. They did not disclose the witnesses who testified in this case. I listed them there, who had knowledge of asbestos. They did not provide the records that showed that Prudential had knowledge of asbestos effects, the economic consequences, extending back to 1985. The record is full of extensive memoranda found by plaintiff's counsel in the Grace suit showing that Prudential's problems with asbestos began in the late 70s, and they were well aware of the impact long before May of 84. That cover-up would have succeeded if there had not been an independent discovery of the Grace suit.
Coming back to the clause itself, again, counsel, tell me what it is that this clause provides the seller that he doesn't have left.
I think he has contractual protections against any type of implied contractual warranty, against any agreement to repair, refurbish, remodel.
Why would
that? It provides
that,
no protection against fraud.
Why would that matter if he could sue for either affirmative misrepresentations or for nondisclosures?
Simply because the courts do not allow contractual terms to waive fraud.
So it doesn't provide him any insulation from liability.
Well, I think I respectfully disagree with Your Honor. It does provide contractual insulation. It does not provide insulation against tort liability.
But why would you, all I'm trying to understand is, if you could sue for tort liability, why would you sue for contract and get the same damages?
Well, if there is no tort, your only remedy is contract. And this negates any contract remedy. If you don't lie about it, you're all right.
Well, or failed to disclose something that should have been disclosed.
That's exactly right.
Doesn't that cover the waterfront?
It covers the tort waterfront. It doesn't cover the contract waterfront. And the clause has a valid purpose in negating that type of contractual liability.
So there is some liability out there, in your view, that this clause insulates you from that you couldn't get any other way.
That's right.
And that is, you say, contract warranty liability.
That's right. That's right.
What would be important enough to be within a contractual warranty that would not come within your view of affirmative duty to disclose?
Well, I think the Mid-Continent case implied contractual warranties about under the Uniform Commercial Code about the building or any of its contents.
But those wouldn't be fraudulent concealment to fail to disclose that to a
Probably not. They could be. Again, it would depend on what the misrepresentations were.
If Prudential had not sued Grace, just decided to get rid of all its buildings, that it didn't have its own employees in them, and it knew that some had asbestos and some not, is that fraudulent concealment?
No, and I think that gets to one of the other non-issues in this case. What we're complaining about is the failure of Prudential to disclose that this building had asbestos. which they knew from the specifications that they had, which
would that always be fraudulent non-disclosure, to fail to disclose that a commercial building has asbestos, if you know that it does?
I think in this case...
I don't think
it always has to be. And again, Your Honor, pardon me for upsetting you about that, but I am so concerned about impressing on the court that these issues are fact-bound. Yes, there could be cases, there have been, where the failure to disclose asbestos is not actionable. Well, they cited two.
Suggest a factual circumstance when it shouldn't be the case, in your view.
There are the two federal district court cases that Prudential has cited. One of them is the owners of the building who built it bought back a reversionary interest from the lender. They knew everything about the building to begin with. They said when we bought from the lender didn't tell us that its motive in selling was that they suspected this building had asbestos. That isn't our case, but that is a case. Another one in Arizona, they cite, La Placida, I think it is, where the contractor went around, examined it, saw the asbestos, had previous experience with asbestos, bought the shopping center, ran it down for a couple of years, and then tried to claim later that the problem was asbestos, even though he had testified that it wouldn't have made any difference to him. Now, my time has expired, I think, predominantly because of the some questions which I'm happy to answer, but since this is my only opportunity...
Anybody wishes, has a question? You may.
I have one short question, and I appreciate it. I want you to clarify for me if I've heard you correctly as far as the chronology of that the jury heard is correct. And if I understand you correctly, the jury heard that Prudential was aware of the existence of asbestos, filed a lawsuit against the provider, installer, manufacturer of these asbestos products in their buildings, that they made a conscious effort to try to unload these buildings on unsuspecting buyers before the presence of asbestos and the dangers of asbestos became general public knowledge, that they delegated the responsibility for representations on this particular building to perhaps an innocent agent that was not aware of the presence, not aware of defects, so that when inquiry was made about the existence of defects, she could honestly say, I'm not aware of any other than this crack in the basement. And that they relied on that, the purchaser relied on that, had no reason to pursue it further, and that barring this conscious misrepresentation, if you will, on the part of Prudential, perhaps through an innocent agent, the as-is contract would have protected Prudential throughout this. This cause of action would not be here today, but it was the existence that the jury heard evidence on of these conscious misrepresentations that put you here today. Is that right?
I appreciate the court's summary. That is exactly right. Well,
assuming what Justice Gamage just said that you agree with, and Ms. Buchanan did not know of the presence of asbestos in this building, what other representations other than her statements are you relying upon as actionable misrepresentations in this case?
As far as affirmative misrepresentations, none. As far as a pattern of concealment, a conscious scheme or plan or design to conceal and fail to disclose asbestos, a bunch of other things.
And would you agree with me that assuming the truth of every other aspect of your case, that if there is no evidence that anyone at Prudential actually knew there was asbestos in this building, that you lose?
Yes, but that's not this case.
And you're going to provide us with the
certainly, because that gets to this whole issue of corporate knowledge, which I haven't had an opportunity to address. It's not just some man named Prudential. It's the collective corporate knowledge of Prudential which supports a jury finding unquestionably in this case.
But that knowledge has to relate to this building,
yes,
right?
Yes, that this building had asbestos sprayed all over the fireproofing, just like this one did.
Thank you, sir.
You say that there is in this record specific information along those lines.
Yes, certainly. And Prudential was examining its home office buildings everywhere. It knew how to do it. When was it built? You look at the specs. You have a test. If it was Monaco during this time period, it was asbestos. Now, if they didn't look at that, or they claim they didn't look at it, that's conscious ignorance. That's the car dealer who has, and this is the case I wanted to cite, in his office, the odometer statement that shows it's been rolled back. And he says, gets an agent, a salesman who doesn't know that, and says, Justice Gamage, as you pointed out, go sell that car. The car dealer is stuck. And we're not equating Prudential to a car dealer necessarily, but we are suggesting that the same rules that apply to car dealers apply to Prudential.
Well, if a car dealer, let's take the statutes out of this. There are odometer statutes. Let's pretend they're not. If a car dealer buys a car that has a lower mileage on it than the average car should have for that model and year, and could get an odometer rollback check, which is not, and sell it just in blissful ignorance, does that amount to fraud? Does that amount to some other of the many causes of action you claim in this case?
Well, it could be. I continue to have difficulty, with great respect, Your Honor, in talking about the facts in these other cases.
Well, the reason we ask, some might say that the Court of Appeals opinion leaves very little room to conduct a business transaction without the potential for liability for actual and gross negligence if something goes wrong with that business deal. And we're going to write this opinion, maybe the only opinion we write this year in this area. You need to think about the implications of it, and we need your help.
Your Honor, in that respect, I think that this Court's opinion in Dallas Farm Machinery against Reeves in 57 considered and addressed all of those concerns. It is cited to you here today because Mr. Hill, in a brief cited last week, cited an earlier case in which some of these concerns were expressed, called a patent, which was expressly overruled in Dallas Farm Machinery. So I think this whole issue of as is has been blown up, exaggerated, deny the writ of error on the Court of Appeals opinion. That doesn't mean you've adopted that opinion. There's no reason for this court to write in this case. I would suggest, among other possibilities the court has, is simply to deny the writ in this case as improvidently granted, because these issues are all fact-bound and found against Prudential by the jury in a case that is impacted by this general charge. And there is no room for an as-is clause to bail Prudential out of this.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Terry, Your Honors, Mr. Hearn, who tried the case, said in the jury argument, I think Mr. Miller did not know about the asbestos in the Jefferson building. I know Mr. Essex didn't. This is what we say they have done wrong in this case. We say they knew so much more about asbestos. As a matter of fact, Prudential is a pioneer in the asbestos problem-related field in this country, except maybe no more than anybody, except maybe the manufacturer. We're saying they should have shared those problems with us. That was his case. That's what they went to the jury on. And now that they see that they met head on in there with the La Placenta case and the 3250 Wilshire Boulevard case and the other as-is cases that clearly hold, and we have filed here, I want obviously, at this, have no time to go into all of these cases. We're very proud of the briefing that we have done in connection with the jurisprudential side of this case. I think our reply brief sets out a lot of good, strong discussion about an as-is contract, what the courts of America have done with it. We're not asking you to do one thing that's out of line with the mainstream of jurisprudence in connection with this. And clearly, all these cases hold that in a case like this, where you have a sophisticated buyer who conducted all of these inspections of himself and who is only complaining about not specific defects in the building, nothing that's building specific, but is complaining about all of these other factors, market conditions and what your lending policies were and whether you had problems in other buildings with tenants or not, and what did you do about them, and who did you tell about it, and who did you didn't. All of the cases line up and say that that is not an actionable case under as-is. At least as-is protects the buyer from those kind of complaints. Now, I will go further with the court in answering the various and sundry questions, but I feel my duty and responsibility here is to this client. And I know that in this case, under these facts, that our client's reliance on as-is is in the absolute mainstream of jurisprudence. If you expand the law and take as-is down and whittle it down and expand the duty of disclosure in a case like this, you will absolutely wreak havoc with commercial transactions in this state. They have not said that anything that I said is disputed in the record. He gets up here and talks about a jury verdict. I understand that. Our position is our summary judgment should have been sustained. Our motion for a directed verdict should have been sustained. Our motion for NOV should have been sustained. We've been on the same horse consistently all the way through, and that is there was no evidence of any affirmative false misrepresentation in this case. Therefore, as is viable and alive as applied to this fact situation.
Finally, the bottom line is you're conceding that if there is misrepresentation, if there is fraud, if there is some affirmative misrepresentation, that as is out of the picture.
I understand that, Your Honor. Absolutely.
That's
see, that's a straw man they set up. They write all their briefs accusing us of something that we are, the cases
basically,
are legion on that.
Basically, your argument is no evidence.
There is absolutely
no evidence.
Conceding
that if there is evidence upon which the jury verdict can be sustained.
If there's evidence of affirmative fraudulent misrepresentation based upon what they say they're relying on, Mrs. Buchanan's statement to Mr. Kirk, yes, but there is not.
Or concealment of material.
Well, we briefed that in our reply about fraudulent concealment. There's some question about whether concealment is actually a cause of action in Texas, but I'm not going to hang my answer on that. I want to be more direct. They're building inference on inference on inference to try to make some kind of concealment case based upon those plans and specifications. The plans and specifications were not concealed from them. No one told them they didn't exist. Anyone in their right mind knows you don't build a four-story building like this without plans and specifications. The fact that if they had them, they couldn't have producing cause or reliance, which is absolutely essential to concealment or false misrepresentation, because Mr. Goldman said himself that he didn't, it wouldn't have made any difference to him whether he had seen the plans and specifications or not. That brings it squarely under these inspection cases, the L.B. Halliday case, and the other cases where it says if there are general conditions out there and you've made your own inspection, you can't come in then and claim that you relied on something else or somebody concealed something from you about, in that case, it was soil conditions. Here they're talking about plans and specifications. Your Honor, Justice Inspector, it's not enough basis for holding a cause of action or a fraudulent concealment to overcome an as-is contract. I respectfully submit. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the court's oral submission docket for today. The foregoing court clauses have been submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez.